Ajahn, I wondered what the, if you would speak about the third foundation of mindfulness and what that is, because I've heard many interpretations of it. And also whether one has to be in jhana. I've read that one has to be in jhana to practice that, the foundations of mindfulness.
No, well, they're well, they're foundations of mindfulness. You don't have to be in jhana to be mindful. That's just awareness, like Gayanupassana, awareness of the body. And that's just like, they say, body in the body and being aware of posture, of breathing, of sensation. You know, so it's a very simple, you know, looking, observing the existing experience of having a body. It's like this, the pressure of sitting or clothes on your, touching your skin or tension or you can, you know, like there's Goenkaji type of sweeping practices where you notice sensation and pleasure, pain, neutral feeling. And like, and then it goes into Vedananupassana, which is like, that's the, you know, the senses, attraction, aversion, pleasure, pain, neutral feeling. And then, and so you're going from the most obvious level of the body to then feeling, and then citta, your mental states. So Jitanupassana, this is a lot of like what Ajahn Chah taught me I caught on to Jitanupassana very quickly because of just awareness of states of mind. And it's just observing, you know, whether you're feeling confused or peaceful or contented or excited or depressed or whatever. So, and then Dhammanupassana Saripatthana is where you're actually using Dhamma teaching, like Four Noble Truths and the dependent origination. You're seeing, you're observing mm-hmm. through the through Dhamma rather than through just, you know, you can actually investigate with these teachings, like the 10 fetters, the 4 stages, the 4 Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the dependent origination, all of that. And so it isn't, you know, they all kind of blend into each other, but it's just a way of emphasizing something. Like Dhammanupassana is, to me, is where you actually you're now in more clear about the path, so you can actually, you know, see things in terms of Dhamma rather than in terms of worldly interpretations or assumptions that we tend to do. So that's where, like, the discerning ability to to know, the knowing ability of consciousness, which is not no longer distorted through perceptions of things, conditioned perceptions. So you can see the conditioned as a condition, and the unconditioned. You know it. You can't see it, but you are that. You know. So you're. There's no, it's not personal anymore. It's not, you know, the tendency to think and personify and define is, you know, you're no longer interested in that. So you're seeing in a very direct, conscious way with wisdom. And then the Dhamma teachings are particularly constructed to be able to reflect, you know, from... in a certain way that is not fraught with a lot of cultural assumptions or personal attitudes. So you know, the Dhamma, Four Noble Truths is not about Asian suffering. Dukkha is a universal. You know, we experience that. It's the same for, you know, everybody can recognize that its causes, its cessation, and the way of not, the path of non-suffering. And then, like, the dependent origination is like, is really helping to deal with the second and third noble truths. So you know, as long as there's avijja or ignorance of Dhamma, then our consciousness and sensory experience and that all are influenced by avijja. So it all ends up as dukkha, as sokka pariteva, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. So avijja is the, you know, bhajya sankhara, sankhara bhajya vijnana, and the sequence of the dependent origination. If there's ignorance of Dhamma, then that affects everything, you know, how you see yourself, your body, the world around you, the universe you're living in. And so if you start, that's why I, like yesterday at the talk, saying, emphasizing this, I'm here to meditate in order to become enlightened in the future, is starting with avijja, isn't it? I mean, I am, my basic assumptions are from ignorance. So in terms of jitanupassana, it's beginning to see that, you know, the self as something, you know, you can actually observe the sense of yourself as a good person, bad person, ignorant or capable, incapable, whatever. It's, you know, there's an awareness that you begin to notice all the different attitudes, assumptions, beliefs you have about yourself as a person. And that awareness is not culturally attuned, conditioned, or affected. I mean, it's universal. You're putting yourself into that universal reality. So rather than operating from distorted conditioning of any sort. And then the Bhatiloma side of the dependent origination is where, you know, the Nirodha, the end of suffering. So that's the cessation or end of the suffering, whatever conditions you're experiencing now that you're suffering from, when you see them in that objective way, then they cease. Their nature's to cease. So you're discerning cessation also. Or Nirodha, the end of suffering as if, you know, absolute end of suffering in terms of conditioned phenomena, but it's the end of suffering that you create at that moment. It'll stop. It'll cease on its own, and then you, more and more, you're confident in being the awareness itself rather than always struggling to become more aware or get jhanas or try to figure out what you should do next. I mean, there's so many opinions floating around the Buddhist world. And just observe how they affect you, you know. You know, I can't say you shouldn't get jhanas either. But what I'm trying to do is say, you know, it's up to you, really. It's not, you know, you might think, oh, I know more than you do, and so you believe everything I say. But what I'm, or if I say you should get the jhanas or you shouldn't bother getting them, then that would, you might grasp what I say. But if you're aware of what I say, how it affects you, that's the point. That you can know. That's direct knowing. It's not speculation anymore, but whatever I say, you know, my effect on you is like this. And you're not saying, it's not even saying it's right or wrong, good or bad, but it is like this. You can know this. Like this moment, you know, there's a knowing of whether you're hot or cold or content or discontented or confused or whatever. And it's that ability to discern this knowing from this point and what is known. They're not the same. But ignorance, they all get confused, they all get aligned together. So we become a person and we make our own conditions the subject of our life, like the sense of myself as a person, as a physical being, as a man or woman or American or whatever. You know, you've taken on that perception, and then you tend to interpret your life experience from those distortions, which always lead to some sort of confusion, unhappiness, suffering, anguish. Because it is ignorance. You know, your whole sense of yourself as a thing, as an object, as a body, as a personality, will only end up being a form of confusion and suffering for you. That's the only way it can be. There's no way you should be as a person. Or, you know, maybe we live our lives trying to construct ourselves into making ourselves better or, you know, having a positive self-image or self-respect. But actually, you know, it's a process of seeing that you're not anything at all. You're not a thing. You're not a condition.
Do you have any different instructions for meditators, especially meditators who are kind of new to meditation, who have quite a severe childhood history of some sort and the apparent dukkha problems appear to be hardwired in, as in a situation will arise and then reaction, we all have that, seems to come unbidden because it's been, well, in neurological terms, the pathway's been well-worn. Any different instructions for how to practice, especially in early practice?
Well, it's a very individual thing. So. Well, mainly, like in because, like in meditation retreats, you know, people that come on 10-day retreats usually, you know, will repress negative emotions and fears, and things start coming into consciousness. So, you know, what I just recommend is just being patient with it, you know, and not trying to do anything with it or think that there's something wrong with you because maybe you're sitting feeling angry when everybody else looks so peaceful. And it is, you know, seeing it as a kind of cleansing process, because actually, like if patience is really the is necessary to deal with past karmic tendencies and repressed feelings and fears that we have. So one thing you emphasize, like I would emphasize the basic foundations of Dana Sila, where you joy and happiness come through generosity, not through selfish obsessions, and so encourage people to be generous or sharing things with others, not demanding, not trying to force the issue, but encouragement, and then towards seeing the value of being responsible for your action and speech. Because a lot in modern society, there's so much blaming going on about, I'm this way because of my mother or father and whatnot. and so we tend to justify maybe our own fears and tendencies out of blaming somebody else, which, in many cases has a certain truth to it, maybe an unloved child or an abused child is not to be denied. But this encouraging the sense of taking on responsibility for action and speech is encouraging them in a good direction. And then you usually start with things like anapanasati and body awareness, just to ground them so that they're more with the actual existing conditions of, the physical body's a heavy condition that that's easy to observe, and then the breath. But even if that doesn't work, then it's just more or less just being patient and repeating, kind of encouraging rather than giving them ideas that they've got to resolve all their childhood problems or they can't really get anywhere till they've resolved their emotional deficiencies, because that makes it, that gives it just feeding the ego again. There's something wrong with you and you've got to fix it before you can ever do vipassana. And I think I would shudder if I ever found myself saying anything like that seriously to anyone. People, I find, that tend to have, most people I come across have are very self-critical and disparaging towards themselves. So it doesn't help, to reinforce that. But the Buddha actually, the difference between Buddha's teaching and any other, any other religion, is its very directness. Not the jhanas, they're common to other, but the satipatthana, or the four noble truths. Because then you're actually, this is unique to Buddhism, Buddha Dhamma. And it's where concentration practices and devotional practice and all that are quite, they have varying, in Christianity and Hinduism, Islam, and all the rest. But in, the unique quality of Buddhism is it's taking suffering and investigating it to where you see the causes and the end of suffering in your mind itself. some people, you know, who are too disturbed to be patient, then you recommend them doing some kind of therapy or way of, you know, talking to somebody else. Or one thing is, it's good to be important to listen to somebody rather than just try to fix all their emotional problems. or to make judgments. You know, like one thing we tend to be frightened or timid about talking to people about maybe our emotional problems, because we're afraid of being judged or rejected or patronized or in some way. So we tend to hold things in. So if you have a friend or a wise therapist who is willing to listen, sometimes just being able to talk and say things that maybe you've never said to anyone in your life, that helps to make it more conscious, make maybe repressed fears and that more conscious, which has a certain cathartic effect. Because, like, really, you know, some people are just so held in and bound up in fear. They don't even know that they are. They're just stuck in a rut, really. And then opportunities to listen, or you can get people to listen to themselves. Like, that's what I did in Thailand, because of the language difficulties, I just listened to myself. And I let it just go on in any way that it wanted to. You know, I wasn't trying to edit it or judge it or correct it. You know, but just be the observer. But some people find that they can't do it. So then that's where psychotherapy can be of use. Certain types of it. Like in England now, psychotherapy is much more in line with meditation than it used to be. Yes?
I guess I have a question about Four Noble Truths and Brahma Viharas. And so there's this Sufi mystic that he said, wisdom tells me I'm nothing, love tells me I'm everything. Between those two, my life unfolds. And so there's a way in which relationships seem so kind of core and fundamental to me, but they're conditioned phenomena. And so, I guess there's a way in which, like, when my mother passes away, the idea that I'll have memories and I can know this memory, or, well, what is it about my mother that I honor or respect, that just doesn't sit right with me. That there's some kind of, I don't know, honoring or respecting of the storyline or the personal history that I just, thinking of people as kind of conditioned props on my stage just doesn't sit right with me. And I have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, it is pretty bleak scenario if you think of it like that. Like like everything and nothing are concepts. And I mean, the thinking mind will, you know, it goes to those extremes, something or not, everything or no thing, or something or anything. And that's where the thought, the thinking ability, you can't think about Nibbana or non-self or the deathless or that. They're beyond thought. You know, the thought is limited to forms and conditions. So it only, you know, so like nothing is like denial of everything. And but and so when we try to conceive nothing, it becomes like a void of, you know, like annihilation, because on a logical level of thinking, and then everything is is all inclusive and the other is all exclusive. But then the reality that we have of awareness is not a condition, not a thought, but it's real. It's here and now, and it's where the thinking process arises and ceases. So that's where this mindfulness is to see the limitation of thoughts, their presence and absence, and to discern when, you know, the doubt in your mind about, you know, is my mother just some memory, and or the stage of my life, is it just a bunch of perceptions? And then we try to evaluate it as, in terms of, it is not very inspiring, or I don't like it, or you know, or maybe we like that. Maybe we like the idea of oblivion, annihilation. But the observer is not liking or disliking, but observing, and that allows for paradox. For, you know, you're not stuck in on the conditioned level of just fixed ways of, you know, rigid attitudes, but you have malleability and you can flow with life because you're no longer bound through ignorance to a particular set of perceptions or conceptions or whatever, you know, that you're conditioned by. You begin to feel much more sense of liberation and freedom from that than you do when you're just trying to operate, say, on a magnanimous, all-inclusive level, or on an annihilationist. Life sucks and then you die kind of thing. I think there's a song. And, you know, seeing it in terms of just despair and misery, or trying to make it always look like this, oh, life is wonderful and one should be always happy with it. But because the mindfulness is not about being happy anymore. But it is where happiness arises and ceases. And then the Brahma-viharas, you know, the metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, they seem to manifest through the empty, through consciousness, not through me trying to make myself full of loving kindness and compassion, but it's, you know, through letting go of self, then what operates is the Brahma-viharas. But it's not a personal, you know, it's not like I can claim that I'm a compassionate person. if I get my personality out of the way, then compassion tends to flow, but it's not me trying to be compassionate. So it's like in that Sufi quote, you know, it's a paradox. And because on the level of thought, it's not just one or the other. Where when you're caught in the thinking mind, then you tend to choose one over the other. Like the idea of Tibetan Buddhism expressing compassion and Theravada wisdom, and it's like then somehow compassion, you know, might we think that that's what I want, compassion. Wisdom can sound pretty cold, you know, just wise sage sitting there and just saying everything arises and ceases. And then a compassionate bodhisattva going out and helping all sentient beings. And these are, you know, ways of using those perceptions. But wisdom doesn't cancel out compassion, compassion doesn't cancel out wisdom, you know. So it's just which word you want to emphasize. It's the same thing, really, but an emphasis on that perceptual level kind of is it may be emphasized in Tibetan Buddhism more than in a way that it's not in Theravada. But it, you know, like Lungpo Cha. Remember when he was in England, and then we took him up to the Manjushri Institute in Cumbria, and so people were asking him questions, and they asked about should I choose to be a selfish arahant or a compassionate bodhisattva? I don't think in Thailand they would even have that problem. But of course, in a European country where Buddhism is new and they're getting influence from all directions, then which shall I choose, the wisdom path or the compassionate one? And of course, his answer was, you know, it's not really a problem. But we can make it into a problem, you know. Can an arahant be selfish? That's totally absurd. Yes?
Could you comment on ways of investigating anxiety as a habit? I appreciate the general question.
About anxiety? Well, this is a fear realm. There's a lot to be anxious about. And the future, you know, right now, sitting here in this room, the future could mean all kinds of things for you. So, I mean, to worry about or be anxious about, you know, so... you know, that's about the future. Possibilities of failure or sickness or loss or, you know, personal or family, social, whatever. One can, you know, we live in an age of anxiety where we worry. And yet, you know, it's... you know, we live in, like Canada, seems to me to be a pretty well-run country, and that you can easily take for granted, you know, that it's secure. But still, I imagine most of you are worrying, are anxious even living in fairly secure governmental economic system. So it's... just the ignorance of the mind believing in the future is, its very nature is uncertain. And so, you know, because we want certainty for the future, you know, we want guarantees or life insurance or commitments and that kind of thing from people around us or the job we have or the political system that affects us. We want promises and certainty from them. Because that would maybe relieve the anxiety to a certain level, where when life becomes totally anarchic, then of course it's more immediate, you know, you don't have the certainty to worry and be anxious about the future. You just more or less have to survive in the immediate present. So sometimes in war, you know, we aren't so, because our instinctual intelligence operates and we have to survive in an anarchic system, then something else comes forth. But in secure societies like here, there's a lot of mental depression, anxiety, worry, because there is a level of certitude that we have, you know. We aren't on the edge of just survival. And I've noticed, you know, in the UK how, you know, you've got a health system. You can survive in England by doing nothing. You know, you've got the society will carry you. So, you know, and this is, but people still, you know, worry and suffer all kinds of anxiety about the future. And that's, just see, that's because of your belief in time as your reality. And the future, like Ajahn Chah's emphasis is on this Thai phrase, mainai, which is uncertain, nothing's for sure. And that not knowing, that very insecurity, doubt, uncertainty, is a focus for peace. Actually, if you begin to just observe, be the observer of insecurity without trying to think about it or blame it, but just surrender to this feeling of not knowing, insecurity, you'll find it peaceful. And this is what the point of Buddhist monasticism is putting us in this state of insecurity, like alms mendicancy, and living right on the edge every day, you know, like we're not supposed to. You know, you give us a meal and then we eat it, and then we have to relinquish it. We can't take the leftovers for the next day. Things like this. So you're actually, you know, the whole structure of alms mendicancy is based on insecurity. And there's a point to this because like Zen Buddhism, the koan style is a deliberate attempt to create insecurity. What's your original face before you were born kind of thing? And asking you impossible conundrums that have no logical meaningful answer. Puts us in, we want to know when we feel uncertain or we have a doubt, or that we want to have the doubt, an answer to the doubt, a solution to the problem. But in meditation, actually that is moving into that very not knowing is a kind of knowing. There's a knowing of not knowing. And that this knowing is direct knowing, where knowing about things is not knowing reality, but knowing about, you know, collecting information and beliefs and teachings of others and just operating from your cultural conditioning. You know, how your society has conditioned you to think and about right, wrong, good and bad. But also, it's you know, this is a fear realm that we're experiencing. You know, this survival of the fittest, law of the jungle. You know, if watch the animal kingdom here in a nice country like Canada. They don't have social security or health care, but they survive, and they don't worry. You know, I'm sure they don't worry. But to worry means like we, like one time I was in Switzerland and some people took me to this revolving restaurant on top of a mountain called the Schilthorn, and you had to go up on these lifts and cable cars and that and get it there. And there's this restaurant on top of a mountain peak, and it slowly revolves, so you get these 360 views of the Swiss mountains, and then you can see the Jungfrau and the Eiger and the monk and all that from this restaurant. And so sitting in the restaurant in the north face of the Eiger was right in front of us. And so Swiss were telling me about how many mountain climbers, this is a challenge to from all over, from Japan, from everywhere they go, to try to climb the north face of the Eiger. And a lot of times they don't make it, they fall off, it's so sheer. And so I asked one of them sitting next to me, I said, why do people do things like that? And he made a very good answer. He said, you know, when you're climbing mountains and your life's in danger, you don't worry. You're with each... You know, you have to be fully with the mountain and your body and where your hands are and your feet. You know, you don't have to worry about, did you pay the electric bill or what your children are up to at home. I mean, you're with that moment. And so that is sometimes in athletics. And you think, you know, you forget yourself. You're completely at one with what you're doing. Or art, or dance, or things like that, where the self falls away and you're just totally at one with bodily movement or the here and now. But then in ordinary life, come back to London, nice, secure flat in Chelsea, and you go in, you've got burglar alarms, you've got... these cameras on the streets, you go in, you've got a guard dog, you can lock the doors, triple lock, go into your well-furnished apartment, sit down and worry.
Jen, you have a long practice. Can you tell us, the lay people, about a little more about the relation between samadhi and sati and samadhi, the last Eightfold Path?
Well, like the Eightfold Path, that is usually, if sila samadhi panya, then in the Eightfold Path it's panya sila samadhi. And because the Eightfold Path is really from samadhi, right understanding. And that's where you know Dhamma. You know, it's not conventional anymore. It's Dhamma. It's the path, and it's from a insight rather than from conceptualizing it. And then from that flow, the sama sangapo, and then the intention toward, and then the course towards right speech, right action, right livelihood. So it comes out of samadhi, not out of just believing in Buddhist teachings anymore, but it's through wisdom. And then when it gets to some vayamo, some effort, some sati sama samadhi, that is like it's effort then is balance and samadhi and effort and concentration are perfectly balanced through sati, through mindfulness. So that's the perfection, the Eightfold Path is a way of talking about the perfection of oneness, of wholeness, completeness, where things are no longer, divided up. So sati, in this sense, is like perfect sati, with where the effort and concentration are no longer out of balance, or one dominates the other. So it's like equanimity or one-pointedness. Efforts, they use a different term for the efforts, and usually, and then in the Eightfold Path they use vayamo, sama vayamo. And because like effort itself is usually comes from, just the habit tendencies and reactivity, and oftentimes we are very willful as personalities, forcing things. And then sama vayamo is no longer like a willful force coming out of ignorance of any sort, but it's perfect presence, balance. And then in terms of what's like the vipaka kamma of our lives, the result of having been born, so we find ourselves, in these physical bodies and their particular problems, tendencies, and also the result of our lives, from the genetic inheritance and the influence of society, parents, and the entrenched habits that we've developed through ignorance, then it's from this mindfulness, then we can, when this karma arises in the present, our relationship to it is seeing it, observing it, and then it ceases. So we're, like anxiety or states of mind like that arise, and there's an awareness of them, of it, so you don't suppress it or follow it. It's just awareness. So then that's a vipaka kamma, but you're not making karma with it anymore. From ignorance, you're not reacting to this feeling of anxiety in the present through trying to get rid of it or just wallowing in it. But you're aware of it. It is what it is. And then you can be aware of its presence, and then that awareness and some right effort, right concentration allows it to be what it is, and it'll naturally, when its karma has ceased, it's gone. You see, so you're aware of the absence of anxiety. So, like concentration also, like samadhi, you know, like we can say, like, there's a samadhi you get through samatha meditation by focusing on an object to the exclusion of everything else. You know, so you, if I'm going to focus on this, then I have to exclude all the rest of you. You know, so I have to get rid of you and put all my concentration onto this mug, coffee mug. But then there's, so that's, I call that the point that excludes everything. And then, but a point can be a little dot, or it can be the totality, you know. Why does it have to be just a point or an object or oneness itself? So then it's the point that includes everything is mindfulness. And then that leads to samadhi, where the samadhi isn't through controlling anymore, through focus on one thing, but it's the samadhi of balance and concentration, where effort and concentration are balanced and whole, complete, full, rather than getting, you know, controlling the mind. So just focus on the cup, I have to discard you. But in mindfulness, then this mindfulness moment includes everything here, you know, including the space in the room, or my own feelings and the presence of you, and the walls and the staircase and the shrine and everything belongs here at this point. And so this is what I call the point that includes and the point that excludes.
Have some advice around the fetter of wanting to not become or not be, working with that?
I know that one very well. started practicing investigating the noble truths and the second noble truth, you know, they give the three kinds of desire and gamadana, bhavadana, vipavadana, and of course gamadana means like sensual desire, so that's quite easy, you know, obvious, you know, what we experience through our senses, the desire for it. But then vipavadanha is a desire to get rid of things. So it's and then bhavadanha is a desire for becoming. So like the English word desire has a kind of pejorative connotation. You know, if you say somebody's full of desires, it means, you know, that's not exactly a compliment, is it? And yet, you know, we can desire very good things, desire the welfare of others and kind of high-minded aspirations. But they all be included in danha. A lot of our meditation is motivated for becoming, to become a stream enterer, or become a meditator that has samadhi, or become something. And then the other desire to get rid of things, get rid of the kilesas, get rid of the fetters, get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion. So that has a kind of righteous quality to it, to get rid of the kilesas, the defilements. Conquer the fetters. Get rid of the forces of evil and ignorance. I mean, this is how I was brought up. Beat the devil, fight the evil forces. So this is a cultural conditioning of my personal background. But I found, like, Vipavadana was gave me a skillful way of looking at my own kind of conditioning, which was very righteous. You know, you've got to get rid of anger and annihilate fear. Jealousy is bad. You've got to get rid of it. And envy. And so this is, I could be, so, you know, because of the tendency, the cultural conditioning, you know, a lot of my life was fighting against or resisting things. And I began to see that in myself, the unhappiness of my life was resisting things, fear and resistance, and trying to control things. So Vipavadana was, I found, a very useful concept for me. Because I could see that, you know, I used to think, that could be my middle name. Mr. Vipavadana Sumedho. You know, Gamadana, you know, I certainly enjoy sensory pleasures and things like this, but it's not the dominating force of my life. I wouldn't be a monk. And then Bhavadanha, I tend towards high-mindedness and wanting to become things. But I would say, you know, what really resonated with me in the first year when I was a Samanera was this Vipavadanha, because I could see that I was really, my approach to life was kind of holding it back, resisting. And once I had that word Vipavadana gave me a way of looking at, of observing, because it was not consciously done. It wasn't like I was consciously doing it. It just was habitual way of reacting to life's experiences. So, that I learned, you know, from probably early childhood. So it wasn't like I was consciously doing it. It was just force of habit. But I couldn't really see it till, you know, I had the opportunity of observing, because it always seemed the right thing to be doing, according to my cultural programming. And even in Thailand, the way they would talk about killing your kilesas, they talk about kill your kilesas, ka kile, they say. And so even us getting it from the Thai position of this kind of heavy-handed, you know, it's just reinforced this tendency to resist or suppress everything, controlling the mind. And then when you lose control, it's you just feel so horrible, you know, like you've gone mad or you're a failure. And so another fear of losing control. And fear of going crazy, fear of losing it, you know, and all these things that you've been resisting taking you over, all these evil forces. Suddenly, when you stop resisting them, they'll just take you over. They completely possess you. And you remember seeing when I was a child. This is one of these, you know. I remember in the 40s, they made a film of Jane Eyre, and I remember seeing this as a child. Jane Eyre. And the scene I most remember was when Jane Eyre opens the door of in the attic room and this mad woman chained to the wall. The most frightening, you know, horrible looking woman, like this, chained to a wall. And that left a strong impression. losing control, that's what happens. You go mad and then they have to chain you in the attic. So the kind of influences you get from movies. And this is the way, you know, Christianity was presented to me. Now, in like Ajahn Mahabua, you know, the Thai Ajahn, he speaks in this very heavy way all the time. Kill your kilesas and fight, fight, fight. And so I could never relate to that because to me that didn't work. You know, I'd done that all my life, fight and against myself. So I found one thing with Ajahn Chah, you see, he had a whole different kind of attitude about it. And then this mindfulness was, and then, you know, getting me to observe myself rather than get rid of my kilesas, observe them, know them for what they are, no desire, you know, like know what desire is. The second noble truth is not killing off desires and not having any, but becoming so familiar with desire that you know exactly what it is. You can't, no matter how it presents, how coarse or subtle the desire might be, you know exactly what it is. And that second noble truth is very skillful at really observing desire. Like Dunha is a natural force this is a desire realm. So, you know, it's not that one never has desires, but there's an increasing knowing of desire. Where before there was, you know, the sensual desire, if it was considered evil or bad or what, then you had to resist it, or anger, and you had to fight against anger, suppress anger, fight against the devil and forces of Satan and things like this. So these were part of a family, cultural, religious conditioning and attitude of a society that I grew up in. With Lungpa Cha, I got this impression that I was expected to live within the restraint of the discipline, but whatever I was feeling, to be aware of it, you know, and that I found, you know, I could do that. I couldn't just wipe out anger as a willful act, but I could be aware of it. And then, like, he advised me to be patient. And he said, you don't have enough patience. And, of course, that first year where you're so frustrated, you know, just learning to fit into a totally different scene in your life would bring up a lot of anger. But this sense of being patient with it helped. So, I mean, it was sometimes, you know, Lungpa Cha would drive me up the walls. He would, you know, because I had to do everything the Thai monks did. I had no special privileges. And I liked this, and I respected him for that. But it also meant that they had an advantage over me, that they understood what he was saying. So you know, in the evening, he was at his peak, at a brilliant peak during those years of teaching. And he could go on in an evening for 5 hours till midnight. And everybody there, you know, a lot of lay people come and everybody was enjoying it. And and he's very funny, they're laughing, and I'm sitting there just raging in. So then I said, you know, I'd like to be excused because I don't understand that. I'm being just very reasonable. It's a perfectly reasonable request, you know. Because I don't understand the language. I think if I spent time practicing samadhi in my kuti, it'd be much more beneficial. And he said, no. And I thought he was being unreasonable. But I did have enough confidence in him to follow his instructions. So I did, you know. And I began to see, you know, how, you know, the anger, being frustrated, not getting your own way, having to put up with physical discomfort, because they're very strict there. You know, you have to sit like you're sitting all the time. When a monk's talking, this is a polite posture, like this, where one leg is off to the side. And I found that excruciatingly painful. So even I'd sit like this, the monk next to me would say, no, no, you can't do that. And so, you know, my knees are hurting and I don't understand the language. He's going on and on and on, rattling away, and everybody's enjoying it but me. So it's a really a good setup for observing. And I did, you know, I did learn from that. Sometimes it surprised me, like one time he was going on for hours and I was just so fed up, you know, I'm going to leave. I can't take this anymore. I'm fed up. And so, anyway, he stopped, gave in his talk, and he dismissed it. Suddenly he looks at me in front of everybody and says, he gives me this radiant smile and says something very pleasant to me. And suddenly, all the anger just disappeared, like dissolved in the. You know. How, you know, here I'm going to leave. I'm not going to put up with this, and I'm getting out of here. And then suddenly, it just dropped like that, and I was a witness of it. You know, one second I'm in a rage, and the next second I'm kind of happy. So I realize that my emotional habits are totally untrustworthy. And then guilt is another problem people have a lot of in the Western world. Because we can never live up to our high-minded principles and standards, usually. You know, so because we're very idealistic, we tend to have ideals of how things should be. The government, our partners, our parents, our society, and oneself. So you've got principles and you've got high standards and aspirations, and one becomes very attached to these ideals, except nobody, including yourself, can live up to them. Now just think what that is, you know, like if you're attached to an ideal, you know, like an intellectual ideal is perfect. You know, you can create, you know, a perfect ideal society where everybody's living in harmony, everybody's equal, everything's fair, everything's just, everyone's compassionate, lions and lambs lie down together and hug each other and things like this. Now that we create ideals like this in the mind, but and so that is beautiful because it's so perfect and how we would like everything to be. But in terms of Dhamma, that's not the way things are. It's like this. It's not just a justification of faults and flaws and corruption and bad behavior, but it is a way of observing what is Dhamma. Dhamma is not ideal. It's about the way things are. And so like each one of us is living through our karma of this life from birth to death. So, like when you want to have a perfect monastery, like where all the monks are living in harmony and everybody's practicing and self-motivated and they're all friends and we all support each other. That's the ideal monastery, but I've never lived in one where that's possible. So I used to get frustrated, starting so many monasteries and then having to deal with so many frustrations and monks and nuns that I found very difficult to live with. And so this is, and then thinking, if everybody could be just this ideal monk, this ideal nun, then everything would be fine. But then, just seeing that's not possible, that it's like this, and that whatever way somebody is, it's not up to me to say you shouldn't be the way you are. It's like encouraging you to observe the yourself, that I can encourage you to do. But for me, I want you to live up to my principles is a very unfair demand on anybody, isn't it? I want you to live in a way that never offends or upsets me. It's not possible. So then, over the years, you just learn how to live with people, It's a common ground of sila that we share, and our intentions are the same, all for liberation from ignorance. So that's as good as you'll get, in terms of, that's the best you can expect. There's a kind of agreed way of living, like the Vinaya, and then the aspiration towards freedom from ignorance, liberation. And then the rest of it, we just have to, have metta or patience, or also using things that, like some of the most difficult people I've lived with, I've learned most from. Because, they bring up very, unpleasant things in myself. And then not wanting them, or wanting them to go away, or wanting them to change, or wanting them to become what I want them to be. You see all this conceit, and I began to see this self-conceit. I know how you should be. And once you begin to notice that, you really think, that's awful, for me to go around telling people, to live their lives so the way that I think they should be is really ignorance. And then this idea of vipaka karma, each one of us is working out our karma, so we can't be. We can only be the way that we are. That's it. It's not that we choose to be like this, but this is what we must learn from our own emotional habits, physical conditions, fears and desires. Then there's a kind of compassion and acceptance of people that I never had before when I was operating from my more narrow views of what I approved of and what I liked and what I felt comfortable with and what I didn't approve of and what made me feel uneasy. In a monastic form, anyone who's really willing to live under the precepts, you take on. You know, it doesn't matter whether I particularly like them or not.
Antamayang tamauvatakatha sathu kalang tathamase.
Sathu.